Here's golf legend John Daly.
Hell yeah, these wins are piling up faster than my divorces.
I only spent on Moto, America's social casino. You know I've won a couple of majors. And on Moto, I've won majors, grands, and epic jackpots on their classic Vegas slots with huge, huge bonus rounds. Moto Casino adds new games and awards players free coins every single day. Grip it and spin it on Moto Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Spring is sprung, and big savings are in full bloom at Menards. Visit Menards Garden Center for everything you need to get your garden growing. Choose from hundreds of beautiful, colorful flowers, lush trees and shrubs, and everything in between. Menards Garden Center is back in bloom. Stop in today to get your garden on. Check out fresh deals happening now at Menards.
Save big money at Menards.
Welcome back to this extra special bonus episode. It's a bonus episode of Across the Movie Aisle. I'm your host, Sonny Bunch. I'm joined, as always, by Peter Suderman. And we've got a very special guest today, Mike Pesca of The Gist. He's a podcasting superstar. We were just talking about the podcasting economy right before we started here. I feel like, you know, Mike's right at the top of it. He's got it all figured out. So we're going to take some lessons from him here today, but I'm excited.
Bleeding edge, right?
Yeah, the bleeding edge. Mike, thanks for joining us. How are you?
I'm the sentinel chicken of podcasting. Remember those when the avian flu was around? They put a chicken in a cage, and if it died, watch out for the flu. That's how I think of myself.
That's cheery. Peter, how are you?
I'm so happy to be talking about movies or television shows or sentinel chickens with friends.
Yeah. All right. So the reason we're doing this episode is because, Mike, your people reached out. They said you wanted to come on and talk about The Pit. And I have also wanted to talk about The Pit. It's, you know, it's HBO Max's big surprise hit. It's wrapping up its second season in a couple of weeks here. The problem is that I am the only person at Across the Movie Aisle who has actually watched the entirety of the show. I think Alyssa watched some. Peter's watched a couple of episodes. He's here mostly to talk about health policy wonk stuff today. I will see. But I'm glad to have you on because I have wanted to do an episode on this for a while now. You, Mike, have been watching every episode. Am I right?
Yes. Up to date. You're watched them all.
Mm-hmm. You're all clear. And I want to be, so we're recording this Tuesday, April 7th. So we have not seen the episode that is coming out Thursday, April 9th. I'm not 100% sure when this will go up. This is going to go up before or after, but so if something crazy, if a nuke goes off in the pit, we have not seen that. We won't have any thoughts. But I don't think that will happen. Hopefully, in theory. Mm-hmm. Anyway, Mike, you've watched the show. You've got an asshole tracker for The Pit. We can talk about that
pit.
In a minute.
The Pit.
I'm excited to get to the asshole tracker myself. But I just want to talk about why I was drawn to the show, because I do think it's really interesting. First and foremost, it's just compelling television, right? The structure is pretty much perfect. Each season covers a shift in a busy Pittsburgh hospital emergency room. We have this core cast of doctors and nurses and security guys who we're following, right? They're led by Dr. Robbie, who's played by Noah Wiley. Funny story here. This was originally kind of intended as an ER spinoff. And they couldn't work it out with the Michael Crichton estate, of course, he's the creator of the show. So they were just like, why don't we just do another doctor show with Noah Wiley? Led to some lawsuits. But it's not far off of ER. Anyway, the students from the first season have graduated to residents in the second. There's a new crop of young docs. They're all kind of prickly. They all have different facets to explore. They're all both stupid and brilliant, kind of in, you know, alternating fashion. It's really fun. Turns out, an ER is a good place for drama. All of humanity watches up through it at their weakest and at their worst, and sometimes at their best. I guess there's a reason that medical and police procedurals continue to dominate the form of television. And this is the second reason I find myself drawn to The Pit. It's really fun watching prestige TV rebuild network TV from first principles, right? Like, the seasons here are longer. Usually a season on HBO is 8 to 10 episodes. These are 13, I believe. They drop weekly instead of all at once. You know, the binge model is kind of dying. HBO never really went to the binge model. They've always kind of held firm here, but this is a sort of show that works perfectly. You try to binge these, which I did in the first season. it gets a little overwhelming. A little overwhelming. 1 hour at a time, that's good. Anyway, it turns out there's a reason that ER ran for 15 seasons. Grey's Anatomy is like nearing the quarter century mark. I think it's at season 22 or 23, something like that. And this creates a kind of a secondary but also interesting business story. I don't know if you want to talk about it at all, Mike, or if you have any thoughts. But like, The Pitt is a rare show that is filmed entirely in Los Angeles, right? It's a real success story for a town that kind of finds itself in the weird position of struggling to attract big productions, which have largely fled overseas. So like, The Pitt is fun. It's got kind of a neat story behind it. It's a neat business of Hollywood story, which I always like. Calls to mind kind of previous great eras of TV. But Mike, you've got some notes, Mike. You've got some thoughts. I know you've got some issues with it. But you like the show. I want to be clear. This is a show, we try to predicate things on like finding things to enjoy on shows. I feel like you do enjoy the show, right? You dig
it. I quite love the show. I guess my two favorite kinds of television are where they reinvent something from scratch that we never thought of before. So The Rehearsal and both seasons of Jury Duty, the second one just ended. Hats off to them, what they were trying to achieve and what they did. And the second type of show that I really like, Pluribus maybe goes in that category too. Like, your mind is just blown by the ambition. But I love exquisite execution. And that's what this is. This is exquisite execution. I think it's probably the best written show on television. My TV writer friends tell me that everyone wanted to be staffed on it. The interconnecting storylines, why we watch television is we identify with characters, and they have a panoply of doctors, and almost all of them you want to know more about. You love them. You love to watch them. But the flaws of the show are very much in line with the fact that it's made in Hollywood and it's made from Hollywood. So as I reported out on my Substack, the Pesca Profundities piece, actually, sorry, it was here's my own branding. It was maybe a gist list piece. Like people listening to this, like, what are these words?
We'll link to all these.
Yes, they have gone in league with a USC program that wants to teach television and movie professionals the realities of healthcare. And in doing so, I would say it's up to the professional writers not to totally imbibe what might be called the indoctrination or propaganda. I'm sure that the people at this program have the best of intentions and want reality. And there is a certain people who write for these shows and produce these shows want to reflect some sort of version of reality on the screen. I remember 15 years ago, I was working for a program called On the Media, and we did a story on how the Smithsonian was now consulting with movies. And the movie that it consulted with to get the verisimilitude, to get the reality, was the Patriot, the Mel Gibson movie, which turned out to be entirely unrealistic in terms of like
slander. Whoa. Hey, there's not going to be any Mel Gibson's Patriot slander on this show today, sir. Mm-hmm. This is one of the great triumphs of American cinema.
So it turns out the Gullah people maybe weren't that enthused about being slaves. That would be what the Smithsonian wasn't consulted on, but the buttons on the military jackets were all exactly like the buttons would be. So that's the version of reality that the Smithsonian was after. I think what this
specifically remember with that movie, that they advertised that you will see a cannonball hit a body in a way you never have before. And it was like, oh, we're going to do cannonball violence for real.
I did the mental checklist of the six ways I have seen a cannonball hit a body. I'm like, all right, both limbs, then the head, gut shot, what's left? And it turns out the cannonball to ass was unprecedented in cinematic history. So this USC program wants to get across the difficulties, the realities. And then I think it's up to the showrunners, it's up to the producers to say thank you very much, and we'll take that as far as it goes. And what I think The Pitt has done to diagnose the problem before I even describe it is they've taken it a bit too far. So we see in The Pitt, with all this great acting and chaos and very realistic seeming blood gushing out, we also see a certain movie of the week preachiness. And what I wrote about is they are up to this point unable to present a patient, a supporting character who is an asshole. There are many assholes, unless that asshole happens to be a white person. So that's what I was noting. And it's of a piece with, we want to use The Pitt to do a lot of social messaging. And part of, or I think maybe the most glaring example of that, we as viewers might not know, oh, is this the reality of the medical system? Is this really how payment works if you're poor? I think we do know, statistically speaking, if there are 50 assholes who show up in the ER, that all 50 of them would be white out of a multicultural cast of people.
This is a Hollywood problem, though, right? If you talk to almost any screenwriter, they will talk about the villain problem. And the villain problem is that as soon as you start making the villains non-white or non-Eastern European, you get into very like, oh, well, is this an Islamophobic film? Is this, is this racist against? And like that is a broad Hollywood filmmaking, television making problem. I will defend the pit here in the sense that it is just a product of its environment, and that is one of the elements of that environment.
Mm-hmm. I have actually spoken to a writer who's done some work in the Hollywood orbit, who told me of the existence of a document by one of the major streaming companies that explicitly laid out what minority characters were and were not allowed to do and what kinds of portrayals of minority characters. Now, I've not confirmed this document. I'm going to tell you, like, this is like third level rumor here. Like, I don't know that this is real, but this is from somebody that I trust. And also, look at the shows. Yeah. Look what you see on TV. This does not shock me as like, this seems like it is plausibly true.
So that is true if there is a villain. I mean, that's probably true overall, but it comes to the fore and challenges the exact thing. One of the main exact things that the show is trying to do, which is reality or verisimilitude. If there is a 50 out of 50, not a 47 out of 50, but a 50 out of 50, 100% rate of white assholes and not even villains. And there's many things to say about the black villain problem. And one is that most black actors hate it. Black screenwriters hate it. Just everyone involved in the creative community hates it for a number of reasons. But when you play it out to this degree and this often, I think it becomes glaring and it hurts the overall show in a non-abstract way, in a more concrete way than they introduce this character in season four. It was an African-American. You wondered, oh, is it going to be a good guy and a bad guy? And they resolve it to, oh, it seemed like a bad guy for two episodes, but then they were really the good guy undercover. You know, that critique is, well, that was obvious given the document you presented and what has been the trend in Hollywood for the last few years. Sure, to make up for past injustices, given, granted, stipulated. But with this show, it's eye rolling after a while. Okay. I've reached that while.
All right, I want to push back on this very slightly in the sense in your definitions here, because I do think that you could categorize the ICE agents on this season as, I think the ICE agents fall into the asshole category. They seem like, you know, they were both actors of color.
Under the mask. So my assessment of that is there are many, I think that a disproportionate, if not majority of, no, just let's go with disproportionate number of ICE agents are in fact Latino. But I think the point there was to make the ICE agents, who were not just doing their job or even doing their job harshly, were pretty much assholes, to make them first and foremost be nameless, faceless functionaries of the superstructure. And that's why the agent had the mask on. And the other thing I'll say is that people have said, Dr. Santos is an asshole, or some of the other doctors of color have their asshole moments. I exclude the doctors because the doctors are supposed to be fully fleshed out people. And none of them are villains, right? They can be people who make bad or hard choices, but we are meant to sympathize with them. And their purpose in the plot is not just to complicate things for the people we root for. So that's why it's a patient tracker. And then I went even further, and I didn't put this in the piece, but an EMT from Pittsburgh, I think maybe they call themselves EMS personnel, did get in touch with me. And they said that many of these stories are ripped from the headlines of things that actually happened. And in several examples that he documented, the actual malefactor was a person of color, but on the show, it's depicted as a white fraternity guy. Yeah.
I want to switch tracks here slightly because I do. The lesson of the week issue is for me, that's a little more glaring. And I don't even mind it that much, in the sense that, like, I don't expect much else here. That said, it does get to be a little bit. What are some of your favorite examples of this on the show through the first two seasons here, where we just have like, look, this is why the system is broken, and, you know, this is what we have to do to fix it, and that sort of thing.
Right. So in season two, and the latest episode, though not when people hear this, will be the return of a father who was very hardworking and I think diabetic, and got himself in a precarious health situation because they had no health care, or that was a major reason. And there were, I didn't actually think that this was shoehorned so artlessly into the show and things like that, this must happen. But it was very clear that they stopped the narrative drive to do a lot of explaining an exposition about the precarities of healthcare and the healthcare system and what can happen, and then what can happen if you don't have healthcare. And then this guy came back quite plausibly having maybe attempted suicide, not a phrase they would ever use on the Pit. He came
committed.
Back maybe because of
committed.
Yes,
you
committed.
Can't say committed.
Is not yes,
committed
you,
is not.
Can
allowed.
You say attempted? I don't know.
Well, it wouldn't be suicide. That would be
an unliving, conscious unliving. Yeah, yeah. In season one, there was a very over-the-top, blaring message of the week exposition about how white doctors, or even at this point, EMTs, who were, I count them as assholes, because the EMTs are almost always heroic, except in the one case where they miss what might be actually happening to a black patient, and that they didn't know. It was their ignorance, and it's often mistaken for some sort of drug reaction, but in fact she had an underlying condition very prevalent in the black community that, of course, white people wouldn't be able to understand. And then before season two, in which there was an act of violence against a member of the nursing staff, season one ended with that. And there was another moment in season one that was extremely ham-handed, where there was a lecture, a mini lecture about the prevalence of violence against healthcare workers somewhere in the middle of the season. So that comes up again and again. And if you look at the chart that I reproduced from USC, in season one, they had a checklist of how many episodes talked about the issues that they wanted talked about. And the answer is, every episode had at least one message from this USC program, and most of the episodes had some sort of violence, precarious state of the healthcare worker today.
Yeah. Yeah.
Here's golf legend John Daly.
Hell yeah, these wins are piling up faster than my divorces.
I only spent on Moto, America's social casino. You know I've won a couple of majors. And on Moto, I've won majors, grands, and epic jackpots on their classic Vegas slots with huge, huge bonus rounds. Moto Casino adds new games and awards players free coins every single day. Grip it and spin it on Moto Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Spring is sprung, and big savings are in full bloom at Menards. Visit Menards Garden Center for everything you need to get your garden growing. Choose from hundreds of beautiful, colorful flowers, lush trees and shrubs, and everything in between. Menards Garden Center is back in bloom. Stop in today to get your garden on. Check out fresh deals happening now at Menards.
Save big money at Menards.
So is this like an adaptation problem? I mean, on the show this week, we talked about difficulties with adaptation and, you know, sort of the question of whether or not when you're adapting Lord of the Rings or Spider-Man, different kind of thing. But like when you're taking source material, you need to be deeply true to the material, or you need to maybe do like what Emerald Fennell did with Wuthering Heights and make something different that is your own. And are you kind of saying they have a, like, they're like the bad video game adaptation that's just a bunch of, Easter eggs from the video game, but isn't really much of a story, isn't much of a plot. Like, it doesn't, you know, it's just there to sort of deliver fan service. Is this kind of healthcare worker fan service?
To your point, and I think the answer to that is no. But to buttress your point, Peter, is all the press material or all the writing, and there was a great piece on the Pit in the New York Times Magazine, and it was laudatory and it didn't get to most of the issues we talked about. But it is clear that Noah Wyle, who is not just the star and the executive producer, but for Noah Wiley's the impetus to essentially do a version of ER where his character is now older, and then, as Sonny laid out, the Crichton estate, which is hilarious to call it the Crichton estate. It seems to be his unbelievably rich widow and Crichton's son, who Crichton never met because the widow was pregnant when he was alive and then the son was born. She just said, no, no, no. And then some smart lawyer said, well, you know, Michael Crichton doesn't own doctor stories. Anyway,
just a doctor drama. It's just a random doctor drama. It's not even in the same city. Come on.
That's right. Different cold weather cities where the football team's character is based on grit. Okay, so to your point, Noah Wiley very much wanted to do this as a cause, as something. Part of the cause was he wanted to give himself meaningful work, but he's, you know, very interested in the union and very interested in social justice. And he does a huge percentage of his time and free time talking to healthcare workers. And his Emmy speech was all about the healthcare workers. And he was very affected. If it wasn't for the COVID lockdowns, he wouldn't have done this show. So yeah, he's unbelievably motivated to get these stories out as stories, as something the public needs to know. But it is so, on the other hand, it is so well done that I think it can subsume some of the preachiness. And by and large, it does. When I put my story out there, a lot of people wanted to object or made objections to me. But then they said sort of sotto voce, well, you're of course right, but we still love the Pit. And that's where we are, I think. Yeah.
Part of the frustration here, and look, I'm I'm a conservative who writes about culture, so I see this a lot. One of the issues here is that conservatives simply do not have, Peter, I'm gonna come to you in a second here. For a long time, did not have anything even remotely like this. There's no version of the Pit, right, where some doctor is like, actually, you should use self-control and not eat 17,000 calories a day, right? Like, there's nothing like that. Indeed, on this
we get
very
that from
on
the
this
head
very
of HHS se- instead.
This is a separate thing. So conservatives don't see their stories kind of entertainingly, but also preachily handled in this way. Usually, if we get anything, it's preachy, right? I said, Peter, I'll come to you in a second, because you've actually watched the show we're about to talk about, or that I'm about to mention here, and I have not, but I've seen the clips, is Landman, right? Mm-hmm. Landman has kind of some of that vibe of, like, here's like a conservative coded character who's going to tell it like it is to his, like, lib daughter, and she's going to, and it's really entertaining, and it's very popular, people love it. There is that is, like, so rare. It's literally the only one I can think of, and I haven't even watched it. So, like, I think that is at least part of what Mike is feeling here.
Yeah, I mean, Landman very much is that, but that's the Taylor Sheridan universe, especially, you know, comes out of Yellowstone, which was very, very popular and was red state coded at the beginning. Actually had an initial adoption pattern that was quite unusual for a sort of prestige, big budget drama, where typically those shows are adopted on the coasts first, and that's where people watch them. And this show came out of sort of smaller mid-market cities in the, in flyover country, right, and in red states, Kansas, St. Louis, places like that. Grand Rapids was where that show sort of started getting popular, and then expanded its popularity over a couple of seasons. And as that show became more popular, and as it became more explicitly associated with a kind of red state worldview, Taylor Sheridan, I think he's also, this is partly just because he's writing like 50 shows a year, 50 episodes of television, some insane amount. Like the monologues in that show, the sort of the I'm going to tell you how it is bits, became much more explicit. And the thing that, you know, with all of these shows, to some degree or another, they're very entertaining and quite well done. And they've got, you know, sort of a great cast of kind of mouthy characters who are, you know, constantly at each other. But it almost always resolves in a Aaron Sorkin-like monologue about exactly, you know, this is what this really means. And Landman really is the West Wing but for red states in a weird way. And I've heard that Taylor Sheridan's new show, which I guess is set partially in New York City, is even more like that. The one with Kurt Russell. I've not seen it yet, though. But
the Madison.
It's just sort of. Yeah. The Madison, yeah, that it's just like Kurt Russell complaining about, you know, how horrible it is to live in New York and like what heathens these people are, and just, you know, very much a kind of a Twitter monologue in television form. And it seems like that's a lot of what The Pitt is doing. And the Taylor Sheridan shows are generally pretty well crafted, if a little loose. And it seems like The Pitt is pretty, you know, is what you're saying is it's the same. Again, I've only seen a few episodes, so, I can't comment on the whole season, the couple of seasons. But it seems like very well done at the craft level. The yep. same time, there's always that moment when they got to turn to the camera and just let you know. But people love that. People love that, right?
Yeah.
I would say the way to do a message show, a conservative show, or a liberal/progressive show, and they're kind of different because within the milieu of Hollywood, you might not even know. There's this unbelievable analogy about this fish not knowing they're inside water. We need to say it again and again. It'll blow your mind. Anyway, within Hollywood, within the left, the people who are working there might not even know that they're doing something preachy or explicit. But the way to do the show is not to have those moments, unless you want to get some extra press for the moment. You just do the show, you present the story, you make it compelling, and you never have a speech about it. But the message is, after a while, that our own guile and hard work won the day. Or are the messages, I mean, I'm sure many on the left would say the many, many police shows are propaganda. But if you actually show, is NYPD a conservative show, or does it show how hard it is to be a police officer and how much danger there is, and present even racist type characters like Sipowicz in a way that absolutely doesn't feel preachy, but does get the point across that this line of work is very hard and it's not because of necessarily systemic inequities. And I think about The Incredibles, which often makes the list of greatest libertarian movies. And I guess Brad Bird is kind of a libertarian if you scratched him, but it was only picked up by libertarians because of one or two lines in the movie. And so I think that's the way you do it. Now, an episodic TV show, you might want the clips to go viral. Like, that's something you might want, that people in your crowd share them as a conservative, qua conservative type show. But I think there is a way to get the messages into shows if you make it clear that, or don't make it clear that you are making a message.
So yeah. I prefer that model for sure. And I think many people do. And there's this kind of constant complaint on the right that, look, we're not asking for shows that deliver a preachy right wing message. What we really want is just shows that aren't preachy at all. And I think there is demand for that. At the same time, we're all journalists here, and all of us are familiar with the concept of a nut graph. Right. And the nut graphs exist in op-eds, in features, in all sorts of journalistic writing. And a lot of what that graph is there to do is to tell you exactly what this means in unambiguous terms, and also to explain to you what you're going to get in the rest of the piece, to be super clear about what it is. Right. You're basically providing a roadmap for the rest of the piece, and also the big idea. You think about the one thing that Hollywood has learned about successful movie trailers over the years, which is, despite the fact that Christopher Nolan hates it, and Christopher Nolan is right, by the way, despite the fact that Christopher Nolan hates it, movie trailers work better when they give away more. Movie people hate that. But it's true for normal audiences. You want to tell them more. You want to signpost, sort of shade all of this stuff more. And even think about, like, then think about on Twitter, political messaging. What works really well, what goes viral, is a great dunk. When somebody just says, this person is wrong, and like goes off on a little, you know, compact rant that explains exactly how this person is so stupid in every way, and you don't understand how the world really is. That's Aaron Sorkin. That's Taylor Sheridan. That's the messaginess of The Pitt. And there's a big audience for that sort of thing, even if it's not my favorite way of sort of delivering those messages.
Yeah, and the audience is very obviously there for The Pitt. You know, our friend, yeah, the entertainment strategy guy, had his ratings report come, and it's just an enormous hit. It does huge numbers for for HBO Max. And because it comes out every week, and because it's a longer season, those numbers, you know, add up. It's like it is a really solid business case for doing longer seasons week by week instead of shorter seasons all at once. This conversation is, it all comes back to, like, we like and watch the show and enjoy it a great deal. Like, this is why I have a hard time getting super worked up about this. And part of it is just because I'm so used to being, again, a conservative who watches these things and, like, kind of lives in this world all the time anyway. Like, yeah, there's some lib propaganda in here. That's the water in which I swim. I see it and I can taste it, but it is.
So you heard the great analogy. I mean, it blew my mind when I heard that. It was once in a graduation speech. So I would say 99% of the time, the explicit messaging that maybe the audience hearkens to, or some version of the audience that likes it on Twitter and is dunking, are the weakest parts of these shows. I think of another HBO show, Hacks, which has many good parts, but then they throw the car in reverse and have, you know, group sessions about cancellation and microaggressions or whatever. And they're almost always the worst parts of the show. And I think they threaten to bring the show down. And even in communities, Reddit communities that love these shows, and I did some investigation, these moments don't land. Sometimes they don't land for people calling them out because they're explicitly against the politics of the people who are watching, but they just don't seem to land as part of the greatness of the show. And the greatness of The Pitt is the energy and the characters who, I mean, we haven't talked about any of the actors. It's interesting to me that so many of them, or at least a few of them, are the children of actors that we know and that we empathize with. Bryan Cranston's daughter is in the show. Brad Dourif's daughter is in the show. They're people in their own right who are great actors. I'm just noting that fact. Yeah, I don't think it works as well as the shows think they do. And the center of USC that I keep talking about is funded by Norman Lear. It's, I have the full title. It's like the Lear Center on Health. But how Norman Lear did it well, or when he did it well, it wasn't that Archie Bunker was explicitly trying to tell you that Archie Bunker was a bigot or that Mike was the hero. They were just making America laugh, and then the message wound its way in. And this is why, I mean, this is a deep cut here, but I think Jonah Goldberg would agree with this. Early seasons of Maude were much better than later seasons of Maude, because when they lose, you know, when your great writers leave because they get a little burned out, all you're left with is, well, the preachiness worked. Let's go back to that.
Yeah, but the problem here is, and we should wrap up here. We're running. But the problem here is that, like, everybody loved Archie Bunker, and he was the favorite character, and everyone was like, oh, that Archie Bunker, he's got some good points.
Right.
And writers hate that, and that's why they have to put the button on it. They're like, okay, you fuckheads, get it right. This is what I'm trying to say.
But what is that show? That shows how damn successful Archie Bunker was as a character. And I've got to think, I haven't heard Lear interviewed on that, if that bothered him. I know it bothered David Chase when Tony Soprano became too much of a hero. And that's why he wrote that scene where actually, you know, Ralphie beats the poor stripper when she's hanging on to a stanchion outside the Bada Bing. He just wanted to make clear these are not people to love. But the fact that we fall in love with these horrible characters is a strength of the writing. And you'd wish the writers would, at some level, or some of the writers in the room would recognize that.
Yeah. It's the Michael Douglas and Wall Street problem.
Or like Christian Bale in American Psycho, like, to go even further with it. Like, it's, you know, the
audiences love charismatic people. They don't love good people. They love charismatic people. I think the smartest.
That's why you have to spell it out. That's why you have to spell it out for the mic. You gotta put a big poster board up that says, actually, this is the problem. That's we don't trust writers. Don't trust audiences for good reason. Audiences are
maybe executives know better. They're like, I don't care if they like Archie or Tony as long as they're watching. Maybe that's the answer. Yeah. By the way, this season of The Pitt, Dr. Robbie, there's a backlash against him. And New York Magazine wrote a piece saying, is he the asshole? And maybe he is or maybe he isn't. But that's good. That's good. That means they're fleshing out the character in interesting ways.
There's a whole nother conversation we could have about the fandom of this show, which is like sprung from the depths of Tumblr in 2013. Like, it's wild. It is a lot of fan fiction that gets like vaguely erotic. A lot of people who are like mad that Noah Wiley talked about life-saving techniques that he learned in Israel. There's a whole Gaza element here. It's
very problematic.
That's another episode. We'll do that some other time.
No, it is all true. Right. Mathematically, for every life you save that you learned in Israel, you kill 10 other people. I don't know if you knew that. That has been proved.
Okay. Fact.
Is that one of those Mike Pesca facts that you published in your database?
That's a fact. I'm just telling you the science as learned by the USC Hollywood and Health and Society program of the Norman Lear Center. That's going to be in the next show.
Good to know. All right, Mike, thanks for being on the show. And Peter, thank you for being on as well, Peter. It's a pleasure always to have Peter Suderman on. All right, that is it for today's show. Many thanks to our subscribers on Substack at movieisle.substack.com. Hey, Mike, what's your URL? Tell folks so we can get them over there.
Well, you should listen to the show, The Gist, or I'm on mikepesca.substack.com. But every day I do The Gist, and every week I do a show called How To, which, you know, self-explanatory. The latest episode is How to Talk to Your Pets.
Is it very carefully?
There's no cat translator. Yeah. Okay. How not to say that was a good episode. You guys don't need it.
All right. All right. Thank you again to Mike Pesca. Check out our merch at our Dashery store. Tell your friends. Strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. If you don't grow, we'll die. If you did not love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter at Sonny Bunch. I'll convince you that this is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys either Tuesday or Wednesday. I don't even know. I don't know when this is going to go up. I don't know when the next episode will be. Just come by the podcast all the time. We're always there.
Here's golf legend John Daly.
Hell yeah, these wins are piling up faster than my divorces.
I only spent on Moto, America's social casino. You know I've won a couple of majors. And on Moto, I've won majors, grands, and epic jackpots on their classic Vegas slots with huge, huge bonus rounds. Moto Casino adds new games and awards players free coins every single day. Grip it and spin it on Moto Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today. Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Spring is sprung, and big savings are in full bloom at Menards. Visit Menards Garden Center for everything you need to get your garden growing. Choose from hundreds of beautiful, colorful flowers, lush trees and shrubs, and everything in between. Menards Garden Center is back in bloom. Stop in today to get your garden on. Check out fresh deals happening now at Menards.
Save.